Coming up on this week's show, we look back on the best of 2023 in retro. And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday and has been all throughout 2023, thanks to our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one book absolutely worth checking out over Christmas is The Secret History of Mac Gaming, the new expanded edition, celebrating the history of gaming on the Apple Macintosh on this gorgeous 480-page hardback book featuring more than 250 Mac titles, including all the classics SimCity, Myst, Spectre, Shadowgate, and lots more as well. Check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our amazing mates at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know about PCBWay. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards and offer services like 3D printing and injection molding and lots more as well. And, of course, they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 408. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show that, of course, every single Friday, all throughout the year, has been bringing you up to speed on all the big happenings in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology. Of course, discussing all the big stories, all the new hardware, all the new titles, all the new indie retro releases, and, of course, bringing you veterans of the industry on the podcast for an interview every single week. And this is the episode that I must admit I do look forward to, actually. This is definitely not the, you know, the filler episode before Christmas. You know, there have been suggestions of that. Definitely not the case. This is actually a celebration of another year of this podcast, because in January, we're going to be celebrating our 8th birthday in the first week of January, which is nuts.
Yeah, and we hit our 400th episode as well, which was really cool. You know, it's amazing that we've kind of done it for this long. And the thing that I love about the podcast is the interviews as well. Having them as our kind of our core thing that happens every week, you know, where we talk about the news, but also we get some fabulous guests on, and we're going to have the highlights of the guests that we've got on this year.
Yeah, so that is essentially what we do at the end of the year, isn't it? A little look back on what's been happening in our lives and what's been happening on the podcast. And then we go through some just little clips of our favourite guests that we've had on the show as well. So I think it's fair to say, Joe, 2023 has been a pretty wild ride, hasn't it? We've crammed a lot into this year.
It's been a pretty crazy year. Yeah, we're a lot of shows, a lot of games markets. Ravi went to Norway again. Dan went to Italy for Amiga show, which, you know, is just crazy that we managed to do these things. And obviously, you know, I just wanted to say we wouldn't be able to do it without, you know, the community and the listeners that, you know, come and listen to us every single week. So, absolutely wild ride this year.
Yeah, it has been. And of course, I think the biggest thing in terms of, you know, surrounding the podcast has been that we've that little project that we started at the end of last year is almost at an end. I know you were up quite late last night packaging up books.
Yeah, a crazy day yesterday. The books, which for our Kickstarter from last December, arrived yesterday morning while I was at work, unexpectedly, I add. They are absolutely amazing. But yeah, a massive, you know, whatever ton lorry it is, turned up at the end of my drive with pallets of books, and my poor wife, bless her, had to handball them all into the house.
Can we show some love to Charlie, by the way?
Yeah, thank you. Massive love for Charlie. And then Ravi came over and, you know, helped out as well in the evening when I got home. And then Dan came and dropped some bits off tonight, in fact. So yeah, it is all missions go, like, you know, with wrapping the books up and getting them sent out.
It's like Santa's little workshop, your house at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, massively. And you know what? And an oversight from our site was, you know, kind of like, my missus was like, how are we going to present them with the t-shirt and stuff like that? And she's making me like wrap them up really nice and stuff, which so they should be, because it is a premium product. But I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, should really.
Well, that's the thing. We've had to think about so many things, like logistics as well, just getting them bought into another country with, you know, all the kind of customs rules and all of this at the moment. And, you know, it's a bit of a nightmare. There's stuff that we've not... we've never published a book before.
We're learning as we go along, aren't we?
We've not got a background in it. So, you know, the fact that we've kind of done all this and reached this point is really good. But also, I think it means we can now focus on pushing the podcast forward for the next year.
Yeah, absolutely. So there have been, so I know we obviously get new listeners all the time. I did see, you know, because I put a little picture on our socials the other day. Quite a lot of people were, hang on, I haven't heard about this before. What, where can I get this book from? This is a Kickstarter we ran pretty much a year ago as now. The books have finally been delivered. So obviously we're going to make sure that all the backers of the Kickstarter get their copy first. And then there should be some extra copies in the new year. And we should have some ebooks to sell on the website as well. So if you didn't get one, good places, followers are just on our social media channels. And of course, if you're a patron backer as well, we'll let our patrons know first as well if there's any extra stock that we can make available after all the backers have got their copies. So very exciting time at the end of the year. And obviously we're trying our very best to get them out to our backers, you know, hopefully before Christmas. And can't promise, because obviously, you know, Christmas delivery is a bit crazy, but if we can do it, we will.
Yeah, I was thinking, guys, like, do you think this year is the year that we've had the most retro stories? I've not found a kind of week yet where I've struggled that much to find news as I did as much a few years ago.
It does feel like it is getting busier all the time, doesn't it? I think when we first started this podcast, it would often be episodes where we'd really struggle to find news stories, but now we have too many of anything.
I remember, you know when you go back and you watch, like, you know, your first YouTube video that you ever did or whatever kind of thing, you look back at moments, and I remember listening back to some episodes, you know, from, you know, 2015, 2016. And it's like in the news, we'd cover like an article, which is like, what's the top 10, you know, PS1 games of all time? Because there wasn't any news. So we'd be like, what's your opinion on this, like, article, guys? Whereas this, like, it is always news. This game's been remade. This indie game's come out, which is retro style.
Another mini console's arrived.
Another mini console. Yeah, exactly. Another event and stuff like that. And, you know, it is amazing how much stuff is coming. And only announced, funny enough, the evening after we recorded last week. We recorded on Thursday last week, and the episode came out
very
on Friday.
Late, yeah.
So very late for us. We usually record on a Monday or Tuesday. Sega have made some pretty huge announcements, haven't they?
Yeah,
which is just crazy. Like, so we would have covered that in the news, but what, there's Crazy Taxi, Golden Axe, Streets of Rage, Jet Set Radio, is it?
Shinobi as well.
Yeah, Shinobi as well. Yeah, God, I missed that one.
Yes, I mean, that is, we did get a lot of messages going, are you guys going to talk about it? Like, oh, we're not really meant to do
we're kind of at the end of the year now.
Yes, I mean, that is incredible to see, and I'm sure that we'll have lots more to talk about on that topic when they arrive in the new year as well. You know, that Sega are basically adding modern twists to some of their beloved brands as well. So I'm very excited about a new Golden Axe. Because, you know, that is, I think, my favourite hack and slash game of all time. So, of course, we'll have plenty of news to bring you up to speed on when we are back after the Christmas break. Next week, it is going to be the, I think, my favourite episode of the year, the Christmas quiz, next Friday.
Yeah, it was good fun. I was kind of nervous hosting it a bit at the beginning. I don't know why, actually. You know,
there's a lot of stress when you're the host of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's so many buttons to press and sound effects. I think I went a bit mad on them at one point. Just lost control of the buttons and sound effects. But yeah, that's always a really good one to enjoy, and we do that next week. Then we have a break.
Yeah.
Our only break for the entire year, actually.
Yeah, then the podcast will be back on the first week of January. So plenty going on. If you're a patron as well, Patrons Hangout is happening tonight, Friday 15th of December, our Christmas special. So if you're listening to this maybe early on Friday morning and you're not a patron member and you want to join us on Patreon, very good time to support us on there and get an invite to our big virtual Christmas do tonight. So all of that going on. But now, shall we have a look back on what an incredible year 2023 has been. Now, we've picked five clips, haven't we, from an incredible library of interviews that we've done. I always find it really difficult just to pick five.
It's tough because, if you know, like you guys have said, we've interviewed some big names this year. And you know what? And some of the smaller names, you know, some of the indie devs and stuff like that have actually been some of our biggest episodes.
Yeah.
But there's been so many moments. I've been listening to so many of our episodes today and I'm just like, big smile on my face. And I'm just like, man, some of these stories have been absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I think we've had a real variety of guests as well. So let's get into our clips now. My first pick is going to be someone that we interviewed back in the summer who was just fascinating. Now, you guys know that I've been on a bit of a, because, you know, our interests in retro kind of change all the time, don't they? And this year I've been really into internet history and exploring kind of early cyber culture and, you know, the early online world as well. And we had a few guests along that theme in 2023, and looking to do more of those in the new year as well. But we spoke to a really interesting lady, Eva Pascoe. Now, this is an interview that we did back in the summer. You were on this one with me, Ravi. And she set up Siberia, which was the first internet cafe in the UK. You remember internet cafes, right?
Yeah. I kind of don't remember them being as cool as this because I was a bit too young. But this was a time when they had like oxygen bars that were popping up in the city and, you know, all these kind of experimental things. But this is a fantastic kind of tale and hearing about those early days of, you know, UK internet culture, but also how cool it was.
Yeah, and, you know, she used to get the likes of David Bowie and, you know, Kylie Minogue hanging out in there as well. They did all-night gaming to, like, the early hours of the morning. Like, it was a post-ravers, like, LAN party that they used to do every Sunday morning. And in this clip, Eva is talking about how they basically went about setting up the first UK internet cafe back in the early 90s, and also how they could have been the 90s version of Spotify.
You know, it was very much a cafe. We had lovely tables, chairs. We had the smell of coffee. You know, there's something about humans. When you put coffee on the table, people talk. And I knew that it was going to happen because I knew that from my coffee shop's experience from Europe. And once you put coffee on the table, people start debate. And also, you know, remember that in that time, your friends were not online. Your normal friends were not online. So if you were a technology fanatic as we were, you had to go and gather with the people who were of that ilk. And once you go to the cyber cafe, you knew you were with your people. That was your tribe. So people were quite happy to chat and help each other and swap stories, swap sites where to get things because, you know, there was no search engine. I think we wrote the first search engine just to help people out in the cafe. And honestly, there was maybe 50 sites on it. You know, that was all. So we had to kind of wait a little bit until things picked up. But eventually people started putting various content that just attracted musicians, attracted game makers. For women, there was a lot of fashion and charities. A lot of early websites were charity sites for campaigning, which is still the case. We still support a lot of charity sites from campaigning. That's the upside of the internet.
Well, I know you've also been a big advocate for, you know, getting women involved in technology. And I did read that in that, you know, that era, 1994, less than 3% of internet users were women. So how did you kind of encourage them to come in and nurture that inclusive environment in Siberia?
Yes, it's hard to believe now because today in the online platforms like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, something like 70% of time is taken by women. So completely swept the other way. But initially, it was quite tricky because even to install internet at home, even on EasyNet, which was the easiest of packages, it was still quite hairy. You know, the modem never worked, things were not compatible with your passwords, with your Microsoft. It was a bit tricky. So unless you had somebody in the family who knew how to set up computer, you really had to come to the cyber cafe. And I was very aware of that and was very excited that, you know, first experience of internet will be with us. And I felt very responsible to make sure that that was a good experience. So we were very careful to introduce people easily. And it was quite helpful that we had a lot of female musicians. So I had girls who then went on to compose and create bands who were our cyber hosts. So they were very, very quick and keen to show people how to source music and also how to upload your own music. Once people realized that this is not a one-way street, that you can upload your material, your art, your music. But women were pretty quick. So, you know, it took a while, but probably by the second year, we were getting to maybe 50-50 ratio.
It's interesting that you talk about music because you had an idea about embedding digital rights into the code that was used by Siberia Records. It seems like something like a early Spotify or one of those ideas. How did that work and come about?
You know, musicians always complain about being ripped off by the recording studios, by the agents. So it's like nothing new about that. And they were complaining then there. And we created this solution with a wonderful French guy, Thibaut Jam, who is still in that space, and Keith Tier, which allowed the musicians to record their music and embed the digital rights track, the signs, the digital cryptography in the music. So that was the business model that we kind of predicted it was going to happen. We were probably about 5 years too early with it. But, you know, then when the musicians started getting really interested in how they can manage large scale releases online, they started coming back and using our documentation. So it wasn't the direction I was going to go, but I kind of regret it a bit because I could have been Spotify.
Way ahead of the curve there.
No.
So yeah, loved having Eva on. Such an interesting story, and one that I've not heard Eva talk about that much before. So it was really interesting to get some exclusives on the podcast. Really enjoyed that. And obviously, if you want to check out the full interviews, I will link up every episode that we talk about here in the show notes, so you can click through and check out the full thing. Now, who's your first choice then, Ravi, for your best of the year?
Yeah, so my first choice is Rob Cunningham, and he was a co-creator of Homeworld, which was a massive title, and Homeworld came out just at the point when 3D accelerated cards started hitting the PCs, and it was one of those kind of space exploration titles that was just absolutely jaw-dropping, and the big thing and a big part of that were the graphics and the way that they used polygons and the little effects that they applied, because a lot of, this kind of creating 3D graphics and stuff, a lot of the effects hadn't been worked out. And in this particular clip, they're talking about the texture budget, the polygon count, but also how, zooming into a craft and using those old kind of pixel art skills means you can represent something with a couple of pixels or a couple of colours and save on all that space and graphics memory.
We kind of touched on already, the fact that hardware accelerated 3D graphics cards were kind of coming in, but not really standard for everyone. Voodoo cards and stuff were still quite expensive then. I mean, how did you kind of keep within the polygon and memory count then? Was that kind of a balancing act?
Oh my God. balancing act, I'd say, is a very, very, nice way of saying it. It was more like a hair on fire, mad freak out that lasted like two or three years. The way we dealt with that was we had extremely limited poly and texture budgets to work with. We would have to design these ships in a way that could be modeled with very limited, polygons, which is actually kind of interesting because, I remember like reading something somewhere about the design of the, some of the ships in Star Wars, particularly the big ships, like the Star Destroyers were these giant, triangular shaped things because it was relatively easy to build them. You could just build massive sheets of wood and plywood and sort of screw them together and then cover them in detail. It was much the same for us back in the day in Homeworld. We had to hand bomb these polygons into shape, and every ship had a very limited polygon budget. And then as you zoomed out, we had to go through procedural scaling to it wasn't procedural actually at the time. We had to hand bomb each level of detail as the ship got smaller on screen and further away from the camera. So yeah, the texture budget was a really big issue. We had, I forget what the budget was for the whole game, but it was laughable compared to modern games. And Aaron Kambitz came up with this incredible method of squeezing detail into pixels that you just couldn't believe it. Like, I think he called it the sub-pixel detailing method or something. by some miracle, he was able to, put colored pixels next to one another and, miraculously articulate detail that just didn't exist in the texture. So, you want to make a hole in the side of the ship and there's a little highlight on one edge and a little shadow on the other. And it's literally like two pixels that are holding that information. And inside there's just sort of like four pixels that are slightly different colored gray, but from the right distance, it looks like there's some, like a little carburetor or something in there, and your mind does all the work. So again, massive props to Aaron Kambitz for coming up with how we did this.
Yeah, really interesting interview with Rob. And obviously, next year is a big year for Homeworld. Homeworld 3 coming out in March. And actually, if you check back on that interview with Rob Cunningham, he gives a little preview on that as well. So maybe you've pre-purchased that on Steam. Definitely worth a listen back at some point over Christmas. So who's your first choice then, Joe?
So my first choice is going to be Mark Tirano, worked for Microsoft and was a, well, he helped create Age of Empires, which was a really, really, really interesting story. And, you know, half the episode was all about Age of Empires and mine and Ravi's kind of like love for it in RTS games.
You know, I didn't think you had that much of a knowledge or love of Age of Empires, but you brought it out, Joe. You know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely loved it. I was doing, embarrassingly doing all my impressions to him at the start of the show.
I did love that. You didn't think I was recording that.
And yeah, but the actual clip I ended up wanting to pick was he went on to, obviously he worked for Microsoft, and he went on to help launch Xbox Live, Xbox 360, and he was actually in the board meetings where they came up with the idea for Xbox achievements, discussing achievements and discussing this with Bill Gates and his kind of investment into, you know, Xbox and Xbox 360 and stuff like that. And, you know, I just thought it was, for me, like, achievements are such a big thing in modern gaming. To have somebody on the show, which we didn't know, to randomly then turn around and go, oh yeah, I was in the board meetings and they didn't think much of it. And now look what it's done to gaming, you know, over the last kind of like 15 years, or if not longer, 18 years, I think. I thought was really, really interesting.
It was sort of two camps. So some people really wanted to, you know, add multiplayer functionality and do it right to their game. You know, other people were not too sure on the investment. And some people, like, inappropriately wanted to put in multiplayer features that just didn't really work for their game, but thought they needed to have it in the marketplace. So, you know, it's always great to sit down with game developers and say, you know, what's your vision for what you want to make? You know, what do you want to do for the audience that you can't do now, and help them solve the technical and design issues, you know, so they can do that. You know, we really tried to, in my technical game manager years, help developers realize their vision. And in some cases, that was, you know, creating a cool multiplayer experience. And in other cases, it was saying, hey, you know, maybe multiplayer is not a thing you should focus on. You know, that's not the value that you're delivering for players. So it's just really helping people, you know, make their best games.
You mentioned obviously being in the meeting for the achievements and obviously not quite understanding how legendary and impactful that would be on kind of like the future of gaming and stuff. But one question that kind of came to mind when you were talking about that then, what was kind of like the developer's kind of first reaction to like Xbox, Microsoft saying, right, you've now got to put these achievements in, there's going to be 1,000 points per game? Because some games, you know, I'm thinking of Dead Rising, really took that on board, Capcom, and, you know, they went out there and, you know, put 50 achievements in there, over 20 points, and some other games would put one achievement in for complete the game, 1,000 points. Was there much of a pushback from some developers, or was it kind of embraced straight away, do you know?
There's, anytime you put something in the TCRs, there's pushback. Because everybody's at, you know, is at different places in their launch cycle. But I think generally people were excited about it. We tried to make the feature as easy as possible for developers to implement. But if it's, you know, add more work and people have already been crunch type scheduled for months, it's not everything could be well received, no matter how good you do. But I think, you know, people could see the value. You know, when you're introducing something new, there's always an adjustment period. But once people got to see it and started to play with it, they were like, okay, this really adds something. You know, I had my own internal struggles with pop-up toast, you know, the little pop-up notifications of things.
Yeah.
Like players entering and, you know, on your friends list, coming in and out. Like, I really wanted to protect the experience from sort of the external notifications of the game system. So putting, you know, I always felt my role in representing game developers was to make sure we put the experience first and the platform didn't get too full of itself, right? Where the achievement quest didn't overshadow what you were doing in the game and what you were feeling in the game. So giving developers control over that, you know, when pop-ups could happen, where they occurred, things like that, was all important to me, that the features respected the primacy of the experience. Yeah.
To be a fly on the wall in those meetings, eh? Yeah. Really interesting. Mark Tirano, so if you want to check out the full interview, of course, you can click through from the show notes as well. Now, one of my favourites this year was someone who is a definite veteran of the industry and has started working on games back in the 70s. This is Atari legend Todd Fry. Now, he's probably best known for the Sword Quest series on the Atari systems, which obviously, you know, we talk about the AVGN documentary in that episode as well, which I think was a lot of people's first introduction to that. Basically, this real-life treasure hunt, wasn't it, where there was real prizes. Unfortunately, the video game crash happened right in the middle of that, so it never got finished. So we talked to Todd all about that. And also the infamous Pac-Man port that he did to the Atari 2600, which a lot of people hated on back in the day. And actually, in this little clip here, because you know one of the things about that Pac-Man port is the flickering on the screen that everyone yes. complains about, and the fact that it's not that similar to the arcade version. So in this section here, we hear a little bit about kind of the development of Pac-Man on the Atari 2600, what caused that flicker, what went wrong, and if you could do it again, maybe how Todd would do things differently.
But I was trying to write a display which would only flicker the amount necessary, so that if two ghosts were down at the bottom of the screen and one ghost was in the middle of the screen and Pac-Man and Ghost was at the top, there would be no flicker. Only if there were three objects that wanted to be in the same horizontal region would it then start flickering. And if you put all five of them in the same horizontal region, then it would start flicking. You notice I keep on talking using the word flicker, because I was working on that, and I had the display that did that when I started working on the algorithm that would make it so that arbitrated which ghost got displayed when. And that was a very complicated thought process for the Atari 2600. And then my boss said, wow, that is really interesting. No one has ever tried anything like that. No one had tried variable flicker before. And I went, wow, why am I doing this? This is hard. And I said, okay, that's fine. Flicker, ghost flicker, Pac-Man doesn't, and shipped it like that. So that in truth, I've gone back and looked at it. I actually recently gave a small presentation on if only Ida, on a algorithm that would have just not done the four ghosts flicker and the Pac-Man doesn't, but just would have said, there are two things I can draw. There are five things I want to draw. What happens if I just flicker everything on a 2/5 duty cycle? It would have been a lot less flicker, and it would have cost least 10 bytes of RAM, I think 15 bytes of ROM, rather, and maybe 4 bits. The problem with using just 4 bits of RAM is that you have to mask it. Well, aside from the fact that I don't think there were 4 bits free, and I don't think I had 15 bytes of ROM left, I'd have to go back and do some juggling. There are other ways to manage the display. The algorithm to actually correctly allocate display slots to reduce flicker to the minimum uses a lot of RAM. The easy one uses a lot of RAM. I wouldn't have been able to do two-player and absolute minimum flicker.
You know, it does sound, Todd, as well, here in this, you know, kind of the design of it as well, and kind of the technical limitations you're up against, it does make sense now. But I mean, at the time, I know some of the reviews did give it a bit of criticism that it was quite different to the arcade version. I mean, how did you kind of handle that at the time?
Well, okay, so Atari had a rule, because back then there was a thing called phosphor burn-in, right? Color televisions, actually, if you left the same image on it, it would burn into the screen, to the chemistry of the materials, to the light-emitting materials on the screen. So we had a thing called attract mode, which would start changing the colors and moving things so that you didn't all have the exact same colors on the exact same spot, particularly in a brightness. So we had phosphor burn-in to contend with. And one of the corollaries of that was there was a rule that said if you are not doing a space game, you can't have a black background with colored objects on it. Because the black background with like white stars, or the black background with like a white maze or a blue maze, is exactly the thing that would cause bad phosphor burn-in. So the rule was, if it's not a space game, can't be black background. Now, Pac-Man itself had a black background with a blue maze. I find this to be almost very, very fascinating. It did not occur to me that it had to have the same colors as Pac-Man Arcade in order to be Pac-Man. I thought if you had ghosts and a maze and dots and a Pac-Man, you'd be Pac-Man. So I put a light orange maze on a light blue background, as I recollect. I'd have to go look at it because it's like I'm...
Yeah.
And that obviously did not look like Pac-Man. And in addition to that, Pac-Man, the game, had these channels to the left and the right that you could scurry out of and circle around the screen. You leave the right side, you come back on the left side. And the nature of the beast is that in the actual display generation for the 2600, you're already doing unique things at the top and bottom. And it's like specific individual code that only runs at the very top and specific individual code that only runs at the very bottom. And to have put channels in the middle, I would have had, right, a different kind of row than the ones that have dots and maze walls. It would have had to be, you know, just way more work to put it on the sides of the top and bottom. I put it at the top and bottom. I thought, you have a channel that can be used to go around and around, and good enough. So, looked wrong, it flickered, the dots were long bars, like soap bar lozenges instead of dots. My fruit was didn't look like fruit. It's like, Jesus Christ, give me a break. I mean, really. So, you know, you say that some, you know, I mean, basically it's one of the most reviled video game releases in history. Let's be honest. There's a tremendous amount of criticism of the ways that it differed from the coin-op. Honestly, I go back and I may have rushed the sounds out without adequate attention, and I apologize for that. I am fascinated by the fact that no one in the whole organization knew that it had to be a blue maze on a black background. Right? If I'd known how important that was, I would have gotten a waiver. I would have said, Pac-Man must be a space game. It's got to be black and blue. It's got to look like Pac-Man. Fact of the matter is, I thought it played enough like Pac-Man and felt enough like Pac-Man that it was Pac-Man.
And obviously Atari have had an incredible year in 2023. You know, new consoles coming out, so many new retro games as well. So if you're an Atari fan, definitely worth a listen to that full interview with Todd Fry. So who have you got for your next one, Ravi?
Yeah, so I've got Joby Otero. And Joby was one of the people that I always wanted to get on the podcast because I remember getting Darkseid, which was a really dark game from Cyber Dreams. And it was all based on H.R. Giger's art. And it just had such a style. It had that early kind of motion capture. But it's really pioneering as well. Do you remember that title?
Yeah, it was incredibly well done. And obviously, like you said, you know, getting artwork like, you know, Giga onto often games and systems that only had like 16 colours.
Yeah.
Such an incredible...
Getting one onto the palette on the screen with the resolution. And in this clip, Toby talks about how they were actually like using physical cutouts and scanning and using early kind of techniques to create this digitization in the game, which, you know, now... We can just do it all automatically, or you can even do it off an image and shove it into a modern program. He had none of that. You know, he was doing it all by hand to create that absolute amazing look. What the process was like of first creating the art, but also digitization, because it was a real mix of, you know, digitization and kind of hand-drawn stuff as well.
Yeah, and... That was a really interesting aspect because this we take for granted how easy it is to get images into a computer now. But back then, there was sort of the early days of flatbed scanners. And we had one Epson flatbed scanner. And it could do decent resolution for the time, like maybe 100 or 150 pixels per inch or whatever. But the images were super grainy. So that alone meant we had to spend so much time reconditioning the artwork to get it to look decent on a computer screen. So that's one reason why we couldn't use Giger's artwork that directly. But the other reason was, of course, we're working with the game design, and the game design has certain environments that it needs in order to make the story make sense and for the interaction to make sense. And you couldn't just like look through Giger's artwork and go, oh yeah, use that location. So a lot of what we did was we'd scan images of his into the computer. We'd clean it up for hour on hour to get the pieces to look more like the original at the resolution we needed. And then we would basically just use little bits and pieces, like tiny portions of the composition, as little cut and paste bits that we would then draw out shapes and fill that in with texture based on little bits and bobs that we would grab from his artwork. So, for example, I might take like the top part of a skull after we'd processed it from the scanner, and then stretch that out into a tree that's 10 times longer than that bit of the skull, and just kind of use that to get some of that Giger lighting and shading, and then hand paint over that in deluxe paint primarily. Until it kind of looked like something that he painted, but in the composition that we needed for those environments.
And was there any video capture, like of VHS as well? Because, you know, Mike Dawson, the main character in it, the kind of way that he walked, but also they had a, you know, kind of a photography look on him as well, that he'd been kind of captured for when they're actually implanting the seed into his brain.
Yeah, that's right. That was all digitized from video of him walking around. I think a lot of that was actually done on a pedestal, and it was captured a frame at a time instead of video. But I think most of the animation of Mike Dawson himself was captured before I joined that project. So I can't say for sure if they literally grabbed video and then digitized that and then cleaned up the frames, or had him actually do one pose at a time and then sequence those frames together. So I can't speak to that part that much, but I can tell you like the part of the intro sequence where you see him up close and then these Giger-esque hands come around the sides of his face and then rip a hole in his forehead, yeah, and the alien seed is injected. That I hand animated in Deluxe Animate in a super arduous process too, because you might recall the game runs at 640 by 350, but there was no animation tool at the time that let you animate directly at that resolution. So I had to animate it in little pieces and then send those pieces to the programmers with coordinates about where those pieces should be displayed within the 640 by 350 window.
Yeah, I love hearing those stories of, you know, kind of the lengths they had to go through to basically do something, like you said, that would be so simple using modern technology. So, yeah, love that interview with Joby. Who's your next one, Joe?
For me, it's going to be this one blew me away. And it was actually probably one of my favorite interviews we've ever done, not just from the year. And this is Ross Tregenza, who works for Sumo Digital at the moment, who's done he's a sound engineer. He's done the soundtrack to many legendary games, including TimeSplitters 2 and TimeSplitters Future Perfect. And I just absolutely loved how he kind of got his story on how he got into the games industry, because he was actually in a industrial goth band as a singer, and actually has quite an expansive music career behind him as well. Mm. And funny enough, Graham Norgate, who we all know as well,
from Rare,
from Rare and TimeSplitters fame and stuff, was a fan of his music and, you know, kind of asked him, do you want to make a track for TimeSplitters 2? And his career just kind of, you know, grew from there. And I found the whole interview so interesting. And I was really torn between this and when he worked on Sonic Team Racing, and he changed the ring noise, the ring collection noise in Sonic, and Sega went ballistic at him.
I think it's very apt as well, because Free Radicals Studios just shut down this week as well.
Yeah.
So it's good to hear about memories of the series.
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminded me of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I probably would have said TimeSplitters 2 is my favorite game of all time, and I probably don't give it enough love these days. So yeah, that's going to be my next pick. That's really interesting. So how did you meet Graham? Where's the kind of the timeline and the story take you there? Because that's fascinating, because it's, you know, you sat there playing TimeSplitters with a cardboard divider, and then before you know it, you're helping out with TimeSplitters 2. Like, connect the dots for me there, because that sounds amazing.
So after my comedy goth band Sneaky Bat Machine, I formed another band called Goteki, which I still do now, 20 years later. It's which is the first band was lovely, but it was very sort of narrow scoped because it was just comedy goth songs, basically. So yeah. Goteki was my more open-ended, like industrial electro band, sort of inspired by Nine Inch Nails and Depeche Mode and stuff like that. And Graham was a fan of my band. He liked my band. And I was playing at a festival, like a all-day festival with a load of bands playing. And I was backstage after we played, and someone said, there's a friend of mine here who really likes your band. He wanted to come say hi, if that's all right. I said, of course it is, yeah. So I said, I do the music for Goteki. What do you do? He said, write music for video games like Time Splitters. And I went absolutely crazy.
Jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, yeah. He was doing a tiny bit of nerding and happy to meet me. And I massively out-nerded him. I really fanboyed on that. But we became friends. And eventually they started work on, I think at that point they were actually already in the process of making Time Splitters 2. And he loved my music and he thought it would be a nice fit somehow for the game. So he said, would I like to try my hand at doing just a remix for the end credits of the game, which I did. And, I realized that was a big deal. I mean, it was a very exciting opportunity for me. So I worked very hard at making it as good as possible. And the fans liked it. Like the QA testers at the time playing the game were listening to it all the time. And it was a big success, which led on to Time Splitters 3, Time Splitters Future Perfect. I wrote, I can't remember, it's either 6 or 8 tracks for that. And so our sort of relationship started getting more professional. And then over time, I was doing like some sound design for him and stuff like that. And then eventually Free Radical expanded in Nottingham. And he had the opportunity to get me to come up and interview to work for him. And I did, and got that job. And that was my entry into the video games industry.
Fantastic. So looking back on 2023 on the Retro Hour podcast and reliving some of our favourite bits of our interviews of the year. Now, my next one, I did mention a bit earlier on that I've kind of done a bit of a dive into the history of online culture this year. So this one I loved doing. Now, this was with Al's Geek Lab, who I'd say, you know, calling him a YouTuber kind of feels like I'm downplaying what he does a little bit. It's more of a documentary maker who just happens to upload his videos, his documentaries onto YouTube. And he did the most in-depth look at the BBS scene days. That is a massive multi-part. I think it works out about like 5-7 hours long. So it's called Back to the BBS. And if you want some viewing over Christmas, absolutely worth checking this out. And basically, in this clip, it's the start of the interview where we kind of explore some memories from the BBS days and how they kind of laid the groundwork for today's internet and these, you know, huge communities that we have online now as well. And also, he touches a bit on the underground scene back then, including those early days of phone freaking.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you hit the nail on the head, right? It's really, it was, there were separate little islands in this digital sea, and you had to dial up a BBS and you never knew what you were going to get. Some of these bulletin boards were what I call stock, and those were the ones to avoid, really. If your BBS looked stock, if you just got a bunch of text and a really rubbish, a really rubbish ANSI art or the lack thereof, then you knew you were probably into a BBS that wasn't really that interesting. And then you'd go in and you'd have a look around and you'd see what the BBS would provide. And maybe it would provide text files. Maybe it would provide some downloads that were shareware. These were all what we'd call the lame BBSs. So you'd have a few text files, shareware games. You know, you could download a copy of Duke Nukem 1 or something like that. You know, the Apogee side of games, that sort of stuff. And a few other things like mod files, which were music modules, and I can talk about those in a bit as well. But you could download some fairly rudimentary files, and you could maybe have a chat with another BBS user if there was one online. But those would be the sort of rubbishy BBSs, the ones that you didn't want to use. And then the next sort of stage up would be BBSs which had multiple telephone lines. And those ones you could probably have a multi-way conference. Now, the thought of having a chat room with multiple people all dialed in and chatting online, oh, that just blew my mind away. Now, you know, in the years that followed, you had things like MSN Messenger on the internet, and you could have chat rooms in that, and IRC and all that sort of stuff. But back then, that wasn't a thing. And so the fact that you could have multiple people talking in real time on a bulletin board was just mind-blowing. And then you had other bulletin boards that ran, like you said, a thing called FidoNet, which was just basically an electronic messaging forum. And you could do two things. One, you could send an what you know was called mail, but it was basically an email to other BBS users, either locally on that same bulletin board or to other bulletin boards anywhere in the world via a FidoNet address. So that was also pretty cool. But then FidoNet wasn't just an email service. It was kind of like Usenet off the internet and an email service all in one. And for those of you who don't know what Usenet is, it's basically a bunch of news groups. And so basically there'd be forums on all sorts of interests. You know, there'd be, you know, a forum on Commodore 64s, there'd be forums on art, there'd be forums on any sort of thought or interest that people had. There'd be a different forum you could go on and you could get immersed in these. You could sit reading forums day and night about different interests that you had. So those were, you know, pretty popular. And yeah, then there were the games as well. And those, the good BBSs had a lot of games attached to them as well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into the gaming aspect of it as well. And, you know, those forums you were talking about then, I mean, I think, you know, my first online experience, I remember spotting an Acorn Archimedes at school that had a modem plugged into it in the computer lab. And
you lucky man.
Yeah, I don't think I was meant to know it was there. I just spotted it one day. And I tried dialing up a service called Kix. I don't know if you remember that, the Computer Information Exchange.
Yes. Yeah. In the back of my mind, yes, I do. I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a commercial service, a bit like Prestel, but it had loads of forums on there. And yeah, I mean, I'd kind of dial that up every week in, you know, IT classes when the teacher wasn't looking. And I got busted one day. But yeah, it was fascinating just seeing real online interaction, you know, going on in real time, which for me, I mean, you know, that experience you described there, it kind of blew my mind as well, just seeing life happen on a screen almost. And I mean, you know, when you kind of got into the scene a bit more, I mean, did you have any kind of favorite boards that you then regularly visited? What were kind of your go-to boards in the early days?
Oh goodness, I mean, that's I did actually try and find some files and things like that, but I honestly cannot remember the names of these BBSs, but at the time of my life, these things were so important to me. And I'm surprised that I can't remember because I would be dialing them every day. But I think what happened is quickly that phone bill problem grew out of hand and I was grounded every other day. You know, I was in trouble at school because I was staying up till 3 a.m. dialing bulletin boards. It just took over my life when I was about 13 or 14. And I think that the answer, I mean, there was two ways to resolve the bill issue. One of them was to do things with the phone network that you shouldn't do. So kids, don't do that. well, I guess these days it's not really a problem because you don't use the telephone system. That was one way.
How did that kind of work though? Was that like phone card kind of hacking and that kind of thing?
In these FIDO mail groups, like I talked about, there were literally groups specifically for phone phreaking, which was the terminology used for, you know, using the phone system for nefarious purposes, include some of it, including getting free phone calls, but there was all sorts of stuff like that. And I don't know if you remember the old BT phone cards. Really early back in the day, the phone cards were totally non-digital. They actually had little etches etched into them by the phone themselves, so that you could, you know, it would tell the phone card, the phone payphone itself, how much you'd used off the card. Well, you could actually make a little score in them that failed to work. And it didn't work every single time, but effectively out of a payphone booth, a phone card one, you could get free phone calls with that little hack. So we knew about that and BT eventually were onto that and they changed their cards. But for a while, that was a really good source of entertainment. And I would show the kids at school how to get free phone calls with that.
Yeah, this one was right up your street as well, wasn't it, Ravi? I know you're also talking about the hacker kind of stuff.
I love that. And I love how the roots of kind of payphones and public phones and freaking and stuff is within, you know, the video game world as well, and how it all kind of connects up. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I loved doing that interview with Al. And even talking about how, you know, kind of the BBS scene is thriving again today. You know, he runs his own BBS. If you want to check that out, I'll link that episode up in the show notes as well. Who's your next pick then, Ravi?
Yes, so my next pick is Rolf Moore. And this was a really interesting story about how he was kind of working in the comic world. He was also working locally as well. So, you know, there was a lot of reference to kind of places that I've kind of grown up at. And, you know, he talked about working for Core, and he was working on Amiga titles at the time. And then later on, he suddenly, you know, got into DreamWorks and got flown to LA and moved over there to work on this crazy project, Trespasser, which was a huge game that DreamWorks kind of designed and built. And we've done some previous episodes on it, but it's great to hear that kind of transition from a rainy Nottingham to a glamorous LA.
Well, tell us a bit about working on that, because, I mean, it was a really groundbreaking title, Trespasser, and it was like it was a CD-ROM sequel to Jurassic Park Lost World, yeah?
Yes, that's what they billed it as, a digital sequel to Jurassic Park Lost World. And it was very ambitious, as you know. I was even skeptical at the time. I thought, I don't quite see how you're going to be able to pull this off. But I trusted them, and they talked a big talk. And we had Seamus Blackley heading up the team, who'd done Flight Unlimited for Looking Glass, and he brought some of his team with him. They had incredibly talented programmers and engineers and artists. It was the most mind-bogglingly talented team I would have come across by that point. And just the environment, of course, being flown over to LA, all of it was just a mind-boggling experience. Even just from when I was in my little flat in London and this huge articulated lorry pulled into our court to take my stuff and my belongings were just put in the back corner of this enormous truck, you know, to transport my stuff over there, and being put up in these nice sort of apartments by the ocean, right near Venice Beach by the ocean. The entire experience was just a trip, and just physically walking around the DreamWorks studios, it felt surreal, you know. And then, you know, seeing Spielberg walk down the corridor, and yeah, it was just sort of really surreal experience.
Sounds like just going into a totally different kind of insane world, really.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was. Yeah, you can imagine. It was such a sort of strange transformation, you know.
Quite a change from Nottingham and Derby.
Yeah, exactly. The bus trip, you know, in the snow and all that, and now sort of hanging out in Hollywood. Yeah, really weird.
Yeah, and I loved in this interview as well when we talked about the famous abandoned Superman Lives movie.
Yes.
That he worked on a bit as well. So it's definitely worth checking out the full interview to hear that tale. Yeah, wonderful. Love chatting to Rolf a bit earlier on this year. So who's your next one, Joe?
So for my next one, this was a really interesting one for me. So this is Jeremy Bluestein, who started his career with Jalico, translating games and localizing, you know, early SNES games and stuff like that. But he did say back then it wasn't called localization, you know, that wasn't a thing when you kind of like made these Japanese games and brought them, you know, to the West and stuff like that. And kind of talking about his story in translating games and living in Japan and then moving back to America and stuff like that was really, really interesting. But what really stood out for me was he did the translation for the legendary game, Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yes.
And, you know, that's become such like a cult classic game. It's one of the most, you know, it's such a rare and expensive game for the PlayStation as well, and it's just got so much kind of like meme behind it as well and like the infamous lines in it where Dracula and Richter meet each other, and just kind of hearing his side of the translation and why he did it, I found such a fascinating story. And he was really passionate about it, and just kind of like, it was really interesting to hear about like how in the 90s how the translations were all dealt with, and it was, by the sounds of things, nowhere near as strict as it was these days. Mm. And it was a little bit of an afterthought, you know, at some companies and stuff like that. But yeah, just hearing about that and his relationship with Konami was just, for me, mind-blowing.
Back to your question, Castlevania, that scene, when I got to the infamous line, you know, I must have had a playable version, because I say that because I was aware of the Yeah, no, for sure. No, I play the Japanese version. I know I did. So I play the Japanese version, and it's like you get to the first scene, and it's like a big scene. It's like Richter's reading Dracula, you know, throws down that wine glass in that classic animation that, you know, it was even more, you know, sort of dramatic than seeing it, you know, as a new game, you know. And I read the Japanese, and I couldn't think of, you know, I'm trying to think of good English lines, really. I mean, in a way, my Japanese brain is reading the line in Japanese and absorbing, okay, it has this information, it has this feeling. But more likely than not, it's a line which is evocative of an earlier line. You know, when we read books, authors choose, you know, words and sentence structures in particular ways because it reverberates for us. But if you just translate something, it's not going to, you know, it's just not going to work. And so the line is just some kind of line like, we shall see the results of what happens by who dies, or, you know, something like that. And it's just like, I could not. And then he throws down a wine glass, you know? And to me, it's just a crap line. And I couldn't think of any way to do something with it. And it seemed such an important, and, you know, and here's Dracula, and he's, you know, he's lived hundreds or thousands of years, you know, he's not going to just say some throwaway line. And so I decided I'll find a quotation. I'll find a great obscure quotation. And that's what set me. And I think they did a search for, you know, like in a quotation book, like they had, you know, humanity or man or something, you know. I looked up, you know, because I was trying to find something deep, you know, and I stumbled on that line.
Yeah.
And I thought it captured his, you know, kind of like mocking nature. And so then I used that. I tried to make the rest of his speech match that character, you know.
So, you know, once you've done that, like the process of translating it, so you've had, you know, you've found that mantra, if you will, that quotation. Does that then go back, once you've put it in the game, does that then go back to approval to Konami, or is it just kind of like you have the you had the final say and it was done? Was that trust there, or was it just, or does it go back to quality?
Well, the simple answer is that I don't know. I don't know, but I can tell you what I suspect. I can tell you what I suspect was the way things were then and how things would be now. That's what I can tell you. So what I suspect was that there simply wasn't anyone to read over my text, of course.
Yeah.
No one would be qualified to do it. And it would take a long flipping time.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be like, you know, it'd be questions everywhere. What does this word mean? What is this? Why do you use this? And so they have a schedule. So no, it was just passed right along. In those times, there was no LQA, which is linguistic quality assurance. Okay? But now it would be checked over many, many, many times in the cycle of my company, Dragon Data, for example, a game localization company located here in Osaka. Thank you very much for the opportunity. We check things over on multiple levels, and then this is before the translation is even submitted, and then after it's submitted, there's a process of LQA and QA where game players play it with the text implemented into it. If there are bugs or strange instances, it goes back to us. We smooth it out. Sometimes when things are I'll leave that for a different time. But yeah, that's generally what would have happened now. And so more likely than not, it just depends on the client. You know, some clients have people that understand that the text needs to be punched up. And some people don't understand it at all. And they actually will say to you, can you, you know, make this more like the Japanese? And we're like, okay, yeah, we'll make your text worse if you want.
So we have got more of our favourite bits of 2023 on the way. Going to hear some of my Games Master memories, a bit of a sneaking code into certain versions of Windows, some South Park games as well. More of those coming up in just a minute. Now, before we do that, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and it has been an incredible sponsor of the Retro Hour all throughout 2023. We want to say a massive thank you to our amazing pals at Shopify. Now, if you use Shopify, this sound will be like music to your ears. You know the sound by now. You know what that means, Ravi? It's a happy sound.
Means you've made a sale.
That's it. It means you've just made money on Shopify. Now, If you're wondering what Shopify is, if you sell anything online or in person, Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Now, that does feel like, you know, one thing that a lot of people have been doing throughout this year is either becoming their own boss or just, you know, setting up a side hustle for a bit of extra money. Obviously, you know, the cost of everything's gone up. If you can earn a few extra quid on the side, a few extra dollars, a few extra euros, definitely worth doing. And Shopify takes care of it all for you. Now, it's a platform that is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Now, for example, I mean, you know, there's so many different things you can sell on there. I'm actually working with a friend of mine at the moment who just, again, is a little side hustle. He's selling comedy Christmas t-shirts.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Good timing.
Exactly. He sold a load of them recently. And before, I mean, he was trying to do stuff through, you know, setting up your own plugins on WordPress. I know Ravi used to design websites for people. Trying to do it yourself with WordPress plugins and all that kind of thing can be a bit of a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. It's a nightmare to maintain. But you also don't get like a shopfront ready point of sale systems. Yeah. You don't get e-commerce, you know, and also, you can't have your sales channels. Like TikTok is something I do not understand these days. But, you know, Shopify lets you kind of go out to TikTok, go out to Instagram, go out to all of the social media, which is really important.
Yeah, which if you want to get customers, that is where you need to be, isn't it? And Shopify even gets you selling across all your social media platforms, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth, gives you complete control of your business. And the most important thing is you can concentrate on making your products. Don't worry about learning new skills, designing, coding, nothing like that. It does it all for you. Now, we want you to try Shopify out for yourself. Now, what's lovely is no matter how big you want to grow, they'll be there to empower you and give you the confidence to take your business to the next level. And there's 24-hour support available as well. So if you want to get serious about selling and your business in 2024 as we get into next year, why don't you check out this link right now? Sign up for a £1 a month trial period and use our link so they know that we sent you. And hopefully, you know, we'll continue sponsoring the podcast if we get enough sales through there. Have a look at shopify.co.uk/retrohour. Sign up for that £1 a month trial. No brainer. shopify.co.uk/retrohour if you want to take your business to the next level today. And get ready to hear a lot more of this in 2024. Right then, more of the best bits of 2023. It has been an amazing year as we continue looking back on some of our favourite guests of the year. And like I said before, it's been very difficult just picking out a few of these because, you know, I think this year, the amount of incredible, interesting guests we've had on has just been second to none. But we do have to pick it, you know, so we just get a few to fit into the episode. Fortunately, we can't look back on everyone. But this one I thought was really fascinating. Now, you joined me on this one, Ravi. This was Kirk Ewing.
Yeah, what a great guest to get on.
Yeah. Now, Kirk, he's got a really interesting history as well, hasn't he? Because he's done so much throughout his career. I think the thing that we really focused on this interview was the amount of controversial games that he's worked on.
We don't get people that often deal with Rockstar and kind of, you know, getting some information and talk about that is absolutely fabulous. But also, Kirk was in the height of the 90s television kind of lads culture as well when it came to video games.
Yeah, now, obviously we talk about stuff like, you know, State of Emergency, JFK Reloaded. But one thing that I found really interesting was, you might remember if you were a viewer of Games Master on TV back in the 90s, that Kirk was a regular presenter on there. You know, he reviewed games, I think, in the start, and then basically became Dominic Diamond's kind of sidekick on a few episodes, because they were really good mates, weren't they? They used to go out kind of, they were best mates really back in the 90s.
Yeah, they had a show afterwards as well, didn't they?
So. Yeah, they did, Night of Plenty. But obviously, one thing that Games Master always gets remembered for is Dave Perry's famous strop when he lost on the Mario 64 challenge. Now, we love Dave Perry as well. We love Dominic Diamond. We've had them all on the podcast in the past. But obviously, there's three people there on stage at the time. We've heard Dominic Diamond's side of it. We've heard Dave Perry's side of it. So now that we had Kirk on, I couldn't resist asking him, what was his memory of the Dave Perry strop from Games Master? I'm going to ask your perspective on it then, because, you know, we've had Dominic on a couple of times. We've had Dave Perry on, Bandana Dave Perry, the games animal.
The other Dave Perry.
You were there, obviously, during the notorious Dave Perry Mario 64 incident.
I was very much
What happened from your perspective then? What memories have you got of that?
Well, I'm a sort of the patsy in all of this because I didn't really know. I mean, I knew that there was some animosity between Dave and the production team. And, you know, Dave is an interesting character. He's charming, very charming on one hand, but he's also a bit of a tosser when he wants to be. So he had probably rubbed some people up, and I guess they decided that they would have a bit of fun with Dave over the Christmas quiz. But I was pretty much unaware of that, as I was most times I was on film, and they didn't really tell me much. They just kind of wheeled me out because I'm pretty, and it got me to do, whatever they said. I didn't expect to be in the final of that quiz at all. Everybody else on the stage, whether it was Rick or Dave, really knows games, and I think their knowledge of games was far superior to mine. And if you go back through it, there's a couple of our firm gym questions, and I was like, this is great, right? At least I'm getting something I can answer. And yes, I had played Mario 64, but not extensively, not kind of crazy times before that. And certainly I don't think I'm even a particularly good video games player. I'm not a games animal like David maybe is. But when it came to it, I think I won fair and square. It's just the rub of the dice. And for my money, Dave should not have jumped to the start, and that was his mistake, mate.
Was it awkward when the camera stopped rolling?
It was really awkward, right? And there's a little bit after that where Dave storms out the studio and the cameras had stopped, and it wasn't. Yeah, at that point, no one felt good about it, and it did feel like a bit like a prank gone wrong. I can't believe that people are still talking about it 30 years later. I mean, it's just madness, isn't it? And I mean,
it's the most notorious Games Master moment, I think, isn't it?
it's just one of those sort of 90s moments that resonates in people's minds. And you know what it's like? If you were there, you were there. And even though Games Master, when you look back, I mean, a lot of it is pretty terrible. There is something really fond about it in my mind, and it still makes me chuckle to watch, all these days and read the comments from people. I love it. It's funny.
So I think it's fair to say we've covered all angles of that now. We're definitely impartial, aren't we?
Yeah, we just need to hear from Mario.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, just Mario on the show next week.
I love that.
So, yeah, I mean, a really interesting episode. Definitely worth checking out that chat with Kirk that we did back in the summer. Now, who's your next one, Ravi?
Yeah, so my next guest is a recent episode, actually, Doug Rappaport. And, we talked about sound in video games, and this was really interesting because he was in that kind of FMV period where, video games were developing, and they were having the original cast put into the video games, stuff like, Starfleet Academy. And I just think it's a kind of changing point in video games for me when you get a cast taking it as seriously as the film release, getting involved. Previously you'd have like a diehard game and you wouldn't have Bruce Willis's voice on it, You'd have someone pretending to be them or sound a bit like them. But this was a real kind of changing point. And in this clip, Doug talks about the Spider-Man game and having Tobey Maguire on there as well. But, getting the original cast involved, making sure it fits within the storyline and the narrative of the film as well. Because as we know, a lot of these old movie games would totally be different to what the kind of movie was like at the time. It must have been tough to kind of convince people that the video games are kind of as worthy as, the TV show.
Absolutely.
And yeah, getting them on board.
And everything in the game. And so... it was the final products of those things were really cool.
Well, another one with the original casting as well was you got involved with Treyarch, and Spider-Man was an absolutely huge task.
Yeah, to Maguire, yeah.
Yeah, and you actually had the cast from the film doing the voiceovers as well.
So, yeah.
That must have been absolutely amazing.
Oh, totally. It's throughout my career, it's always been exciting to work with the real cast from things. And I remember I directed Tobin Bell from Saw for the Saw video game, from the horror franchise. And he was really cool too. And it's like, you see someone in a movie like that and he's so evil and stuff like that. But you meet him in person and they're the nicest people and such a great person to work with. And so over the years, you really find, you have your favorites of people working with. And he was one of them. He was really cool to work with. I think, with Spider-Man, with Tobey Maguire and Willem Dafoe, everybody has their own personality and sometimes personalities conflict in the studio. And like I said, with the William Shatner thing, but the end result is what's important.
I was going to wonder about the Spider-Man one, it being so close to the movie as well.
Right.
Was there a lot of focus on keeping the dialogue accurate and kind of, there'd obviously be sequel films coming out and stuff, you know, making sure the storyline was consistent with the Spider-Man world.
Yeah, it was really cool, actually, on Spider-Man, because a select group of us, only a small amount of people, were allowed to go and read the script, you know, before the movie was out or even finished, I think. And it was top secret to see the script. So, like, we had to go in, if I'm remembering correctly, like, a few at a time, and they wouldn't let us leave the room with the script. We had to read it right then and there, and they watched us. So we had the advanced knowledge of reading the script and seeing the, you know, getting an idea of what the movie was going to be like, you know, before, you know, working on the video game. And that, you know, having read the scripts, the script for it, you know, really informed us to, you know, to make a video game that would be a, you know, an equal companion for the movie.
Yes, I love that interview with Doug, and you and proper nerded out about Star Trek on it as well, didn't you? Obviously, yes. Being a loyal Trekkie.
So, live long and prosper. Yeah.
Whenever Ravi gets a chance. Who's your next one then, Joe?
So my next one is Neil Glancy, which me and you did, Dan, yeah, you did. Towards the start of the year, which was a real fun one because he started out, you know, talking about his time working on Amiga games and all the graphics he did on some absolutely stunning games on there and some of the lighting effects and everything.
DMA Design, he was that, wasn't he?
Yeah. Was really, really cool. But then he had a really great career with the N64. At Acclaim and Iguana, and he helped make the South Park 64 game, which, you know, depending how you look at it, is either an absolutely excellent game that lots of people have got a lot of love for, or a bit of an infamous game. And just kind of sitting back and listening to his entire story about kind of like, the, you know, from the very beginnings of the development of that game, when they first got the rights to South Park, when literally only the pilot episode of South Park had aired. And then literally they got greenlit to do some, like, you know, small, like, encyclopedia, you know, just look like screensavers and stuff like that, you know, on your PC. Mm. To then all of a sudden South Park was massive within like 3 or 4 episodes. And they're like, boom, we need a first person shooter in the Turok engine, and you've got 8 months to make it. and then unfortunately, the Columbine Massacre happened, and they had to completely change the game, and they had to get Nintendo to sign it off. And yeah, it was just an absolutely excellent story to hear about that game, and just kind of like, you know, the trials they had to go through to get that game out, and, you know, to finally then get it out and it'd be, you know, a really, really, in my opinion, a fantastic game which sold pretty well. So yeah, love that one.
Jeff spoke to me, you know, and he's like, hey, we've got the South Park thing, you know, would you be interested in working on the South Park game? And I was like, hell yeah, that sounds great. The major challenge though was they wanted the product for Christmas of that year. And I think we were having that conversation in maybe March, early April, which meant that we only had months basically to, you know, design, build, and execute and deliver the product, which was insane, right? You know, doing anything in such a short time is just incredibly difficult. So we, you know, we looked at kind of what we had, and at that time we only really had the Turok engine, which was a first-person shooter engine. Turok obviously being the game where you run around shooting dinosaurs, which was a big deal on the Nintendo 64. So we were like, okay, well, it's going to have to be a first-person shooter of some sort. We looked at the reference material because the show had started to air on Comedy Central at that time. I believe there were maybe 3 or 4 episodes in. There was not a lot of episodes for us to refer to. But there was this one episode in the early season where the kids went hunting with Uncle Jimbo, and it was like, you know, oh, look, it's a bear, it's coming right at me, blam, you know. We're like, okay, well, the kids, you know, we can see them in the show here with, you know, guns and things like that. So having them running around with guns should be fine. And, you know, we were running this stuff up the flagpole with Comedy Central and Casa Bonita, which was the studio name for the South Park studio. Everyone was happy at that time. And then Columbine happened. And when Columbine happened, everyone was obviously completely stunned and shocked, but there came down word from Comedy Central that they're like, hey, we cannot have a game with children with guns in it. And we were obviously, we understood, you know, this, but we were like, well, what do we do now? Because, you know, we have a first person engine. Well, I mean, you know, we don't have a lot of room to maneuver here. And I remember talking to the team and my leads at the time and being like, shit, we are really in a tight spot here. you know, set creativity knob to maximum. You know, how are we going to get out of this problem? So we thought about it for some time. And basically this idea was floated that, well, instead of having the kids, you know, holding different guns and actual weapons, maybe we could have them hold sort of cheeky toy-like equivalents, you know. So instead of having a pistol, you know, we could have a character holding a snowball. And, you know, instead of the secondary fire on a pistol being, you know, burst shot, for example, that the secondary fire on the snowball could be a yellow snowball, you know, that does more damage. You know, or we could have things like, you know, Terence and Philip fart dolls, which are essentially grenades. You know, you sort of throw them in the world, they explode in a cloud of fart gas, but they're still a grenade, they're area of effect, damaging. So we basically substituted all of the different weapons that we had in the design with kind of toy equivalents. And then I went back to a Comedy Central to meet with them in New York and to meet with Matt and Trey in LA. And I had to pitch them, you know, like, here's how we think we're going to fix this and move forward. You know, what do you guys think? And very fortunately for us, Comedy Central and Casa Bonita were all super happy with the workaround. They're like, this is really a great workaround. You know, let's just continue to move forward. So we had to scramble to continue the production of the game. It was an incredibly challenging project to deliver because of the short timeline. I believe we had about 9 months to make the game.
Yeah, really interesting chat with Neil. I loved hearing about his work on our Walker as well. That was one of my favourite Amiga games. And also the ill-fated Walker 2 never happened. So I need to get back in touch with him, actually. He did mention to me in the interview that maybe he's got some artwork at his mum's house in the attic or something back in Scotland.
Dan's going to recreate Walker 2 next year, everybody.
Watch this space. I wish I had the skills. So yeah, if you want to check out, of course, as we're talking about these and you're hearing these clips of full episodes, check the show notes. We've just got, I think, one more each then before we wrap up for the year, before the Christmas quiz next week. And this one was one that I worked on for a long time because he's a very busy man, but I'm really pleased that it came through. And this is at Dave Plummer. Now, Dave Plummer runs a fascinating YouTube channel called Dave's Garage, but his history is that actually he was a programmer who worked for Microsoft for many years and also did some work on the Amiga as well back in the day. You probably know him from work on stuff like the Space Cadet pinball game that he ported over to Windows NT. He's also the guy that put the Task Manager in Windows and stuff like, you know, zip folders are in there as well, and also Windows Activation. He was the guy that implemented that back in the day. There is one thing that is really fascinating, though, about Windows Activation, which, you know, hearing that sentence, you'd be thinking, really? But it is a way that basically he implemented it into Windows XP, and that is by sneaking in Microsoft Bob. Now, if you don't remember what Microsoft Bob was, that was basically that. It was like a kid's interface, wasn't it, for Windows?
Yeah, it was really weird. It was like your operating system was a house. And you could kind of select different items from there. But kind of bringing that back into XP is a really interesting move because it's quite a failed operating system as well. And it was released in 1995.
Well, around that time, I mean, you know, we're talking about the run-up to Windows XP now. And, you know, Windows 2000 was released. It's still my favorite version of Windows of all time, Windows 2000. And then when XP was launched, basically the home and the NT kernels were merged, weren't they? And it became a product that was based on NT then. And one of your claims to fame, and I've seen your great YouTube video about this, but maybe you can just kind of summarize it for people that haven't watched that video yet, is you managed to sneak Microsoft Bob into Windows XP. So what happened there?
Well, as much as I'd like to say I can neither confirm nor deny the presence of Microsoft Bob in Windows XP, the reality is I was doing product activation for XP. It was one of the last things I worked on. And there was the problem of how do we ship a set of keys that are tied to the BIOS of the machine in a way that people can't easily duplicate and just post to Usenet at the time, because alt binaries was kind of or alt wares, those things were the main distribution mechanism. And so I decided, well, if we've got slack space on the CD, I'm going to make a large file, which in that day was 10 megabytes, and I'm going to digitally encrypt it and use it as a massive key that you have to have along with the CD key in order to activate the product. So if you're going to download a crack, it's going to have at least 10 megabytes of completely random data that doesn't compress. And I looked around for things I could use, and I thought, well, I could just call CryptGenRand and generate a whole bunch of data, but that's no fun. So I went up on the product servers and I grabbed the disk images from Microsoft Bob. Then I encrypted them with the WinZip encryption, and then ultimately with PGP and one other mechanism, and with keys that I honestly can't remember today. So there's no chance of it coming back until they break that encryption, I imagine. But so this ballast of a large file that was tied to your CD key is actually the image of Microsoft Bob.
That's hilarious. So that must have meant, you know, Microsoft Bob then must have been a lot more widespread than anyone realized back then.
Yeah, by far, probably shipped 1,000 to 1 in terms of distribution.
So I love that, you know, Microsoft Bob, that was obviously one of Microsoft's biggest failures, actually ended up being sold 400 million times, technically, because that's how many copies of Windows XP were sold in the first 5 years before that was retired in 2014. So I love the fact that there is a little sneaky bit of Microsoft Bob in most people's hard disk back then. So I'm going to check out that full interview with Dave. Absolutely worth a listen. So who's your final guest of the year then, Ravi?
Yeah, my final guest of the year is a guest that that wouldn't usually have on the podcast, actually. I don't think we've ever covered edutainment games, apart from this guest who's absolutely fabulous. It was Mark Brown, the inventor of the Arthur Kids TV series.
Yeah.
And I thought this was such an interesting angle and such a different episode to ones that we usually do. That kind of looking at his approach to the Arthur video games, but also how, you know, they were getting pushed by Bill Gates. You know, he's a personal fan of the series. How the interface has changed, how kind of, you know, the technology developed over time, and so did the games. And also, you know, this clip, Mark talks about maintaining kind of Arthur's world in a, and setting a commercial balance as well, because, you know, you could have a lot of pressure from people to kind of maybe sell junk food or do other things with the Arthur brand. And he always wanted to have, you know, a kind of idea of learning or creativity with the game. And yeah, this is just a fantastic clip. And to be honest, it was an absolute honor to have him on. And it was an honor to hear Joe sing the Arthur theme song as well. Because I know at the time, a lot of other video games about kids, there was a huge kind of advertising swell of like, you know, products and sweets and all of that kind of stuff going into there. Did you get any pressure, or were you kind of protected by Living Books from that, really?
Oh, we were protected. I don't remember anything like that, but it's certainly something that would have bumped up against me if we were asked to do something like that. I mean, I'm just horrified by the way television has used, seduced children with animation and with commercials that get them to want to eat certain kinds of things or buy certain kinds of toys. So I had a natural resistance to that when I entered the world of licensing. I had this contract with an agent at the time, so I was kind of locked in to this world where I was constantly bumping up against things I didn't want to do. I didn't want Arthur to be a part of. And it took that 3-year cycle for me to be able to fire this agent and sort of scale back the licensing. So Arthur was associated with puzzles and games and things that were helpful to kids.
It sounds, that's a really interesting point there, because obviously you kept that creative control and you knew kind of the boundaries you wanted to set for, you know, the world of Arthur.
Yeah.
But also, how did you find, you know, obviously working with the guys on a video game, did you have to strike a balance between education and entertainment when developing these games?
You know, I didn't know anything else. I wanted it both. I believe that kids learn best with humor. That's where my books came from. There was always some kind of educational or learning element within the books. I had an agenda with every story for kids. And that's what we did with the television show. Kids ask me, where do your ideas come from? And it's so easy. They come from real life. Things that happen to my kids would become stories. I remember Tolan, when he was about 5, he wanted to go to day camp, but he was a little afraid of leaving home for the day and being, you know, in some place strange with strange people. And from that experience and watching him struggle with that came the book Arthur Goes to Camp. And then my other son, Tucker, when he was in second grade, he wanted desperately to lose a tooth. Everyone in his class, I think, had lost teeth. And so he was trying to wiggle teeth that wouldn't wiggle. And that turned into another Arthur story, Arthur's Tooth. So, you know, I explained to kids that there are great stories around us every day. We just have to keep our eyes open, our ears open, and find something to start that story within us and then have fun with it. And basically, that's my job.
All throughout that little clip there, I'm just thinking of the theme tune stuck in my head now. How about Joe's muted himself, is he?
I did go on an alpha binge, on an alpha binge after watching that episode.
What a kind of day, hey, when you learn to love and play.
Yeah, I thought you muted your mic and you're just singing it loudly. So, yeah, that was really interesting hearing, you know, the story of the living books as well and how, you know, they made a comeback this year. So if you want to nostalgic look back at Elwood City's digital domain, definitely worth checking out that interview with Mark. So who's your final guest of 2023 then, Joe?
So my final guest, which actually ended up being, so I've been told by Dan, one of our most popular episodes for listeners, one of our most listened to episodes of the year, was Lewis and Mike from Dreamcast Junkyard. So it's always great, you know, to have another, you know, another podcast on. So they do the Dream Pod podcast, which is absolutely fantastic. And obviously they do Dreamcast Junkyard, which is the website, which is everything about Dreamcast. And I just really enjoyed our chat with them and just kind of talking about the community that they've built and the Dreamcast community, and the fact that it kind of, like, Dreamcast Junkyard led on to the first Dreamcast book being published and the first kind of full, you know, widely available list of every single Dreamcast game that was out there, and just talking about, like, where the scene is now and what Dreamcast has been up to for the last 20 years. And also just their absolute tremendous tolerance to me and Ravi, because we were having an absolute technical nightmare on that episode and we ended up having to record it twice.
No one knows about the madness that goes on in the background.
And it was really a rehearsal, nice Joe. It was a rehearsal and they were absolute superstars. And I really, really enjoyed having them on. And it was just like kicking it back with a couple of mates that episode. And it was really fun.
So we've had a steady trickle of indie games coming out. I think COVID and the lockdowns, I think, just centered people a little bit more. So we saw, as with other consoles, we saw a massive price rise. But with Dreamcast, it was really quite extreme. I mean, you know, the prices, especially in America, doubled pretty much within a couple of weeks. It was a ridiculously quick increase in pricing, which is always a bit weird because the console, which is probably the least protection for games of any sort of generation of consoles. So, you know, you can literally download games. But yeah, the scene is getting bigger, I think, year on year. I think there's more and more people getting involved with it. I think you've got more people discovering the Dreamcast as well, which is always brilliant. And I think also you've got a lot of people talking about Dreamcast. Obviously, we're on a podcast here talking about Dreamcast. But when the DreamPod first came out, I mean, it was the first Dreamcast podcast.
Yeah.
As far as we know, it was the first Dreamcast podcast. And I'd say I published the list, the glorified list. It was pretty much the first Dreamcast book. It's become a much bigger thing now, so that's a benefit to all of us, especially us, me and Lewis, because it means we can talk about the console even more than we already do.
Yeah, I will add, you have stuff as well like GDMU, and that allows people to just swap out that dying GD-ROM drive from their Dreamcast for something that just plays games off an SD card. So it's like easier than ever to just dive in and find some new games or play the ones you played back in the day.
That's brilliant. It's good to see, like, nobody kind of like gatekeeping it either or anything like that. And like such a welcoming community with, you know, with things like that, what allow people to just to kind of get stuck in with it and stuff. So that's fantastic. So how do you guys kind of stay up to date with news and developments related to the Dreamcast and its games? Like, you know, so many years after it's been discontinued.
I will say that, like, over the years, we've kind of got the privilege, like, we're in kind of a privileged position in the sense that, like, people, you know, contact the Junkyard and say, hey guys, like, you know, I've got this, you know, new indie release, or I've got this new thing I'm working on, like a homebrew thing. And, So we kind of get like contacted that way. So that's like really cool. But I think if you want to, like get to the beating heart of the Dreamcast community, even before it goes up on the junkyard, I'd say go on the Dreamcast Talk forums or any of those kind of similar discords where you see like developers posting stuff. And like people, like there's a guy called Ian Michael who just does homebrew stuff just because he wants to, you know. He made like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collection for the Dreamcast where you can play all the old games. It's just because he wants to, and that's like the beauty of it. So like we find out a lot of that from forums, and obviously I say people contact us. So yeah, like if you want to know exactly what's going on like in real time, just get on one of those forums and find out. Yeah,
I love that episode as well. I think it just proves, you know, the fact that, like you said, it was one of our most popular episodes of the year, how much people love the Dreamcast. So I think definitely a system that we'll need to look at a bit more maybe in 2024.
And the amount of games coming out as well and titles.
Yeah, so that's been our look back at some of our favourite moments of this podcast in 2023. Can I just say a massive thank you to everyone who's been with us throughout this incredible journey this year, everyone that's listened to an episode, everyone that's come on as a guest, of course, our incredible patrons. We couldn't do the podcast without you, and hopefully you'll be joining us tonight for the big virtual Christmas party. And if you'd like to join us on Patreon, it's a little reminder that, you know, you can sign up any point, you know, on our website and help us see this podcast into 2024, because we are going to be here in January again to bring you up to speed on what's been happening, and we've already got some guests in the bag.
Killer guests as well. I'm really excited to go into next year.
Yeah, so we're definitely going to hit the ground running in January. So thanks again from the bottom of our hearts. Really means a lot to us that you're here with us every single Friday. And we'll see you next Friday for the quiz. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.